on how you react to what you see, that's how God will reward us. We can say, oh, things are terrible. I can't stand it. This is terrible. That's like being like the 10 spies. But when you say, things are good because God is good and God is with us, that's like being like the 2 spies. All right, go on, spies. Matter of perspective. There's this story that I really enjoy about a small shtetl, a small Jewish community in Eastern Europe. And there was an old man in the community, sort of one of the elder types of the community, who would wait at the road. And whenever anyone was approaching the village and looked like they were, moving in, because in those days the pogroms and such, that people were always on the move and looking for new places to settle. And when he'd see people coming, that like they were going to maybe move into the community, he'd say, he'd say, well, where are you coming from? And they'd say, well, we're coming from, such and such a place. And he'd say, well, what are the people like there? And if they would say, oh, the people there, they're terrible. They're got this problem and that problem. And there's this, and so on. Then the old man would say, that's exactly the way the people are here. You don't want to live here. But if the people coming from the other village would say, we love the people we're with, we really miss them, and there's a beautiful community, then the old man would say, that's exactly the way the people are here. You should settle here and live here. But it's the same people he's describing, wasn't it? So it's the he's checking the heart of the traveler. It's a matter of perspective. We're back in the book of Hebrews. I think this is, this is our 14th week on the book of Hebrews. And I think, we've moved through the difficult material of the book of Hebrews. And we are probably ready to, we're like wrapping it up now. We've started wrapping it up because he's made his main points. And now he's just got to unpack a little bit. So imagine yourself reading this epistle as a part of the community to whom it was written. Let's just say you are a believer, a Jew, and you first became a disciple 30-some years ago. And you have now proudly been with the Jerusalem Yeshua movement ever since its beginning, so 30-some years. You heard the apostles speaking. You personally knew a few of the 12. They're all gone now. But you knew Yaakov. Yaakov, the brother of Yeshua, was the head of your congregation. How's that for a feather in your cap? He's gone now. Your sanctuary now, your house of worship, was the holy temple of God. It's like, where does your congregation meet? Oh, you can't really miss it. You see this hill up here? You just want to go up the steps. You've been meeting in Solomon's portico, right inside the eastern gate, because you want to be there when Messiah comes through. That's where you've been meeting for the last 30-some years. But this is gone now, because you've been forbidden from ever entering that holy place again. And you know that you will never again feel that holy ground of the Temple Mount under your bare feet. Never again will you breathe the incense of the daily prayers. You will never again hear the Levites singing the daily psalms. Never again will you see the blood splashed against the altar, because the entire community of believers have been excommunicated from the temple. So imagine yourself reading this letter, hearing this letter read, which speaks of how this temple on earth, which is your congregational place of assembly, that while this temple in Jerusalem is significant, it's important, it's Torah ordained, it's only a shadow of a greater one in heaven. And how this priesthood on earth is only a shadow of the work of Messiah. And how Messiah has effected a new covenant, and he now presides as high priest over that new covenant. Not a covenant that displaces the old covenant, but rather one that answers the old covenant. Writing Torah on human hearts. If the first covenant was Sinai, at Sinai was the holy place, the writer of the book of Hebrews said, then this new covenant is holy of holies. fabulous stuff. You'd really be enjoying this letter, I think. It's encouragement. It's joy. But it is weak on a few of the practical points. Some of your more practical questions. And this is where we start to begin. We start to get into the practical stuff. He's going to jog aside, and we'll do this chapter on faith in a few weeks here, Hebrews 11. But 10 and 12 and 13 are really just like, okay, now I've made my point. What do we do now? So we start to get into some of these practical points today. So imagine yourself reading this letter and you're thinking, all right, I've got the heavenly stuff, the spiritual greater picture, but my concern is really right now. Where am I going to go this Shabbat? Where do we assemble? How do we assemble? What do we do? How do we bring a sacrifice if we bring a sacrifice outside of the temple? How are we supposed to do a Passover? These sorts of questions. And practically speaking, from the Torah perspective, from the Leviticus perspective, from the Vayikra perspective, how do we draw near to the presence of the living God on earth? I've got this thing about in heaven down, you know, in the world to come, but this is the world right now. How do we approach God right now? See, in the Torah, when God came down to tabernacle among His people, in His tabernacle, His presence on earth, He said, if anyone wants to draw near to Me, let him bring a sacrifice. The Hebrew word for sacrifice is korban, which means something brought near. And that's what the sacrificial system, with all of its ritual purity laws and everything, the cleansing ceremonies, was all about. It's all about how to enter into the presence of God here on earth, in His tabernacle. It's about coming close to God. Not as we think of coming close to God. We think of, you know, coming close to God in terms of prayer and meditation and singing, maybe a quiet time or whatever, or coming into the anointing or something like that. Not like that at all. Rather, entering His holy place, His holy space, space defined by God that says, "My presence is here." How do you do that? That's what the sacrificial system was all about. In Hebrew, the idiom to draw near, as it's used in the Torah, to come near, doesn't imply separation. Like, you're close to God, but you're not quite there yet. Rather, when you draw near to God, you are in His presence. You've arrived at it. Same function with the kingdom of heaven is near, is to say the kingdom of heaven is here. So how do we draw near? We accept, the writer of the book of Hebrews says, you know, this. He advances this whole premise about Messiah's priesthood, the heavenly temple, eternal life. But come on, what does it practically mean right now, right here? So, that's where we're at. Having completed this long and complex argument, Messiah's priesthood, the new covenant, our writer now turns his attention to some practical matters. Chapter 10, verse 19. Therefore, and the therefore following the big everything which came before. Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Yeshua, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain that is His body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Now, which holy place is he speaking about here? Is he speaking about the holy place in Jerusalem, or the holy place which is the real holy place of which the Jerusalem temple is just a reflection? Surely he's speaking of the eternal temple. No one was going to try to enter the holy place in Jerusalem and say, well, I can enter here because, you know, I've been washed in the blood of Messiah. He's speaking of the eternal temple which has been opened up for us. But just as the temple on earth is a reflection of the eternal temple, so too is the way in which the heavenly temple was opened through the blood of Messiah. You will remember from the Gospels, the Jerusalem temple, the reflection, was also opened. Because as the Son breathed His last, what happened? The Father rent His garments And the curtain before the Holy of Holies was torn asunder. And Haderech, the way into the most holy place, was revealed. And so the sect that followed him were called the Way. So the writer of the book of Hebrews says, wasn't that curtain his body? Isn't it his body that was rent to provide a new and living way before God? So you see, these two temples are not disconnected from one another. They are intrinsically connected. The Jerusalem temple being the reflection of the heavenly temple. Which is why, you know, people say, why would believers long for a rebuilding of a temple in Jerusalem? Because the absence of a temple in Jerusalem is an absence of the earthly manifestation of the spiritual reality. Anyway, he goes on to say, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience and having our bodies washed with pure water, in verse 22. These are standard temple rituals for drawing near. If you were to, as a believer, you were going up to the temple to meet at your assembly, there's two things you would need to submit to in order to gain admission to the temple and hence draw near to God. You know, you come here to Beth Emmanuel and, you know, you have, there's really nothing that, there are very few things that we're going to require of you in order to enter the sanctuary here. But if you try to enter the temple in Jerusalem, according to the Torah, you would first need to undergo a sprinkling with the ashes of the red heifer. If you had been in contact with any sort of death or contamination, which most people would have been. And second, you would need to pass through an immersion in a mikvah, a baptism ritual, washing with water. So the writer of the book of Hebrews spiritualizes these two physical rituals. In this passage, he says, your flesh isn't sprinkled to cleanse you from corpse contamination, but your heart now is sprinkled to cleanse you from sin. And the wages of sin are death. Your body isn't washed to remove ritual pollution before entering the temple, but your body is washed in the immersion into Messiah. So he spiritualizes these two rituals for entering the temple. And then in verse 23, it goes on, let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. And let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another all the more as you see the day approaching. So Messiah sprinkles our hearts. He washes our bodies so that we can draw near. But when you draw near, you're supposed to bring a sacrifice. What is the sacrifice we're supposed to bring? Here's a sacrifice. Holding on to hope, love, and good deeds. Hope, love, and good deeds. How did Paul put it? Hope, love, and faith? Faith? But faith is faithfulness expressed. The expression of faith is, according to James, deeds. Hope, love, good deeds. Good deeds are the skin that we put on the bones of faith. In a Jewish reading of the text, there's not a question here, or there shouldn't be a question. I should qualify that. There shouldn't be a question for a Jewish reader reading the text. Good deeds equal mitzvot, the commandments. Anytime, you see this all the time, from ancient literature on to the present. A good deed, a mitzvah, these are the same thing. A commandment, mitzvah means commandment. A commandment is oftentimes translated into, say, English as good deed. So, good deeds equals Torah from a Jewish cultural perspective. No problem there, you would think. I was in, when I was in Seattle last week, I was making this point, saying, you know the passage in Matthew where the master says, he says it this way, he says, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Do not think that I came to do away with the Torah, but whoever keeps the least of these commandments. You know this passage. It works just like that. Bing, bing, bing. Good deeds equals Torah. This is like self-evident. So from a Jewish reading, this is very clear. Good deeds equals Torah. So let your light shine. Do mitzvot. Hide your light under a basket or whatever. A bushel? Was it? A bowl? Concealing your light? Don't. That's not doing mitzvot. That's not keeping Torah. So this messianic rabbi, a Jewish fellow, said, I have a problem with that. So you have a problem? You know, this is really what he says. I have a problem with that. I don't think you can equate good deeds and Torah. You cannot equate good deeds and I said, why not? You know, it's like there's 613 good deeds in the Torah. So how can you not equate them? He says, well, I know that. I don't think you can. You know, it's astounding to me. I'm continually astounded by the messianic movement. Is this repudiation, constant repudiation of Torah. I don't know what to do with it, to be honest. It just baffles me. Anyway. What do we learn from the Master regarding good deeds and the 613 commandments of the Torah? Here's what he said. Matthew 22, he said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. We do this in the Shema every week. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the Torah and the prophets hang on these two commandments, which means the 611 additional commandments hang on these two for a total of 613. Therefore, love of God, love of neighbor is the basis of all the commandments of Torah, love and good deeds. You maybe read some of the work of Moshe Pesach in the First Fruits of Zion magazine, but he hasn't written for about a year, but he just submitted an article that I really enjoyed last week, and it's he points out, he says, you know, we have this argument that the law is divided into the civil, the moral, and the ritual, ceremonial. And this is a typical church argument. So he says, you know, the church says that only the moral law remains, whereas and maybe some of the civil, whereas the ritual is certainly, that's the part of the law that's done away with. Okay. But the Master says, love is the basis of all the commandments. So the question is love ritual, moral, or civil? Surely love is moral. Therefore, all Torah is moral. Ha! He goes on to conclude the article with what I thought was a very powerful point. He said, there are plenty of good atheists keeping the moral laws. It takes a man or a woman of faith to keep the ritual. So this means all the mitzvot are acts of love. All the commandments are acts of love for God and for fellow man. So he says, verse 25, he goes on, let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, all the more as you see the day approaching. This is a passage usually used to show why you should be going to church on Sunday. If you've heard this in a church, you know, that's, let us not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but let's encourage one another, all, you know. But what is the context here in the book of Hebrews? The context is the temple, the ecclesia, the assembly. The problem the whole reason for writing this book was that the ecclesia, the assembly, could no longer episunogage in the accustomed place. That's a little Greek for you. Episunogage, assemble. It's the word, obviously the word we get synagogue from. So the assembly, the church, the ecclesia, could no longer synagogue in the temple. So why bother assembling at all if you can't go to the place where you're supposed to assemble? This isn't so hard for our Hellenist writer. He lives outside of Jerusalem. He's never been able to assemble in the temple. They assemble in the synagogue every week. He says, continue to assemble. Is the temple the only place to episunagoge around? What about the sunagoge? Some people believe the believers left the synagogue and formed their own synagogues, you know, and so on in the Acts record. I believe the historical record on this is pretty clear that they did not until very late. In fact, Acts 15 assumes they are still in the synagogues, the mainstream synagogues. And the 19th bracha of the Amidah, which was written in 90 by the council at Yavne, the one that kicks the believers out of the synagogues, obviously the believers are still in the synagogues if you need a blessing that's supposed to get them out of the synagogues. So the believers remain within the synagogues, which is actually, come to think of it, that's what we are doing here. The synagogue is the authentic expression of faith in Messiah. It's the original practice and service. But notice that, I want you to notice what they are assembling together for. He doesn't say, go assemble so that you can hear the nice liturgies or something like that. He doesn't say that. He says, so you may encourage one another. This is the point of assembling, so you may encourage one another. So you can encourage each other and spur each other on in love and good deeds. When we gather here at Beth Emmanuel, it is in part to encourage each other in our service to the King, to love and good deeds. I was thinking about this because I was on this text this week, and so I was just kind of going through my mind, you know, because I'm the one, more than anyone, that needs to be convinced why we need to assemble. It seems like it'd be so much easier not to assemble. You know, it's just, well, for one thing, we could stay home. And it just seems like it'd be so much, you know, wouldn't that be a nice, if we have to have innovations in religion, couldn't we get one, you know, I'm able to thank God, the Lord's blessed me with the ability to work from my home, which is great. That means I don't have to go to work. Now if we could just assemble in my home, I'd never have to leave. It's hard to assemble. It's not hard to get together, you know, like if to go to an event. Like if your congregation is if you're going there to be entertained or whatever, and or it's not hard to get together to go, you know, if you're there for like some a spiritual event and to get the emotional value or whatever. But in order to really accomplish this objective, to encourage one another and to spur one another on to love and good deeds, that's hard. But that's the function of the assembly, is to facilitate mitzvot. You cannot keep Torah in isolation. It was given to a community. It's a community covenant document. We cannot do it alone. From what I know of the people who are in this movement, if we could do it alone, we would do it alone. Almost everyone in this movement they are sort of rugged individualists. They have asked the difficult questions, and they have made difficult transitions. They have left the mainstream. It doesn't make for a cohesive type of community when you get a room full of rugged individualists. It would be easier to do this in isolation. You know, I can certainly see that. And you could even make this argument. You could say, all those commandments to assemble on the Sabbath, to hold a mikra, a sacred assembly on the festivals, those don't apply to us because those commands were for the temple, not the local congregations. Right? It makes sense. Literal reading of the Torah. That would be the conclusion. No temple, no obligation to get together with anybody else. It could have worked in Jerusalem. Kicked out of the temple. Hey, do you think I'm going to keep assembling? I'm staying home. I'm going to sleep in. It's not easy to get along. You know, we fight about doctrine or something. We have these culture clashes. The religious people in the world are generally more irritable and uptight than the other people because they know that God's watching. So that even the most seemingly innocuous things come with religious conviction, you know, like, you're going to eat that? So, So then, you know, something happens and you're with your congregation or whatever, or you just kind of start to get a feeling or something, or it's like, I don't like this part or whatever. And, or maybe somebody makes you mad and it's like, to heck with this. Who needs this? I'm out of here. But the writer of the book of Hebrews binds the mitzvah of assembly upon us, even without a temple. People are leaving assemblies all the time. We are a culture of leavers. We don't see much of that here at Beth Emmanuel. Do you know why? Because we've only been around about 6 months. But it is true. We are a culture of leavers with a very short attention span. Every church, everywhere in the modern age, in America, is really just a stopping place. It's like a brief pause as we leap from congregation to congregation, which is okay. We can do that. It's not a sin. But the problem is it never allows community to really form. Especially intergenerationally, where we see marriages give birth to families, give birth to bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, which give birth to marriages, which give birth to families. And we are family on a real level. I mean, we'll never experience that. You know? If I look out, I don't want to be a prophet of doom here, but if I took a snapshot now and then took a snapshot in 10 years, how many of us would be still here? Where do you see something like that? I'll tell you where you see that. You see that in the Orthodox community. And that's the only place you see it. Why? Because they have a lot more invested in community, practically speaking. Not that they're better people, not that they are nicer people or get along or give each other more space or whatever, but seriously, they have a lot more invested, their houses. Because according to Orthodox halakha, it is forbidden to drive on the Shabbat. Starting your car would be making a fire, which would be violating the Sabbath. Therefore, they don't drive on the Shabbat. Therefore, they need to live within walking distance of the place of assembly. Therefore, their community is not an artificial community in the sense of, let's be community here, and they don't have programs to figure out how we can make community happen. It just happens to be that your neighbor is also the person you worship with. It's a natural effect. So when you get mad, when you get ticked off, when you have a doctrinal problem, when you have a bad feeling that things maybe just aren't right or something, what are you going to do? Sell your house? No, it's because selling your house is a little bit more serious. You're going to work through it. You're going to say, okay, I don't have to like everything. I don't even have to like everybody. But I do have to be part of this community because I am part of this community. If we could somehow internalize that psychology, well, I don't know. There's always people with all different levels of conviction in any community. The beauty of community is when people with different levels of conviction and different ideas and different motivations can get along with each other. And I think that's what the point of assembling together is that when we overcome our differences in order to assemble together, we're doing something not for our own sake, not for anybody else's sake, but for God's sake. So the point is, I mean, this is a twisted way of thinking about it. The more you dislike the people you assemble with, the better. Because that's a bigger mitzvah. And the reward for loving them and assembling with them will be greater. Listen, I like all of you, so there is no mitzvah here for me. I miss you when I'm gone. The Lord moves people from community to community for one reason or another, and everyone knows that the modern attrition rate at any place of worship is enormous. And all of you who have come here have come from other places that you left. Because we've only been here 6 months. No one was born into this community. And when you leave this place, you'll probably go someplace else. And that's okay. You know what? At Beth Emmanuel, we have an open door policy. Don't let the screen door hit you as you come in. And we don't want you to leave. But, you know, that's okay too. But here's something I was thinking about. Regarding this high attrition rate and why we keep moving on, trying out new congregations and so on. It occurred to me that our culture, for the most part, we just have a short attention span and very low sense of loyalty. We have a plurality of options that is always encouraging us to try something different. That's normal. I mean, it's like you have all these different things to try. You would try this, try that, try this. It used to be you could only get 3 channels on your television, at least where I was from. Now you have remote controls for channel surfing, so you don't even need to take the effort to stand up to change the station in order to try something else. It used to be that when you got married, that was pretty much a permanent state, you know, till death do us part, short of bereavement. But now, you know, people try out several spouses, one after another, in a sick and twisted courting ritual called dating, where we take potential spouses out for test drives like cars until we find one we like.
Right.
Half of all married folks decide that they'd like to try changing the channel, you know? You know, that you probably hear that term thrown around, half of all marriages, 50% of all marriages. You know, actually, the percentage is much higher among evangelical Christians. That's the norm. So is it any wonder that we don't have a sense of loyalty to our congregation? We don't even have a sense of loyalty to our families. But when we leave our congregations, one after another, the problem is we can never go deep. Imagine if you left your husband or wife after the first big fight and never troubled to work through it and go deeper. And be like, oh, but I'm really hurt, you know? Because that's what we do with our congregations. The writer of the book of Hebrews tells us, you want to draw near to God in this world? Here's how you do it. Number one, hold on to your faith. Number two, spur each other on to love and Torah. And number three, don't give up assembling together. When the going gets tough, the tough usually get going out the door. But when we run from place to place, we're missing the opportunity to achieve spiritual greatness. For the believers, the writer of the book of Hebrews was addressing the temptation to give up assembling together, not simply on the basis of doctrinal disagreement or petty annoyance. It wasn't because they didn't like the worship or the liturgy. It was because by assembling together, they were putting their lives at risk. It was a time of great persecution when it was safer to just stay home and mind one's own business. Therefore, he writes, don't give up assembling together, but encourage one another. Verse 26 says, if we deliberately keep on sinning after we receive the knowledge of the truth, no sacrifice for sins is left, but only a fearful expectation of judgment and of raging fire that will consume the enemies of God. See, in the Torah, there is no sacrifice for intentional sin. And he's playing with that concept here. Anyone who rejected the Torah of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses. In the Torah age, you know, under the Sanhedrin and Jewish court of law that's enforcing Torah, you couldn't say, well, I realize I broke the Shabbat, but I brought a sacrifice. That wouldn't buy you anything. Anyone who rejected the Torah of Moses died without mercy on the testimony of 2 or 3 witnesses. So you would think the next verse should say, isn't it a good thing that we live under grace now? Verse 29 says, how much more severely do you think a man deserves to be punished who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, who has treated as an unholy thing the blood of the covenant that sanctified him, who has insulted the Spirit of grace? In other words, if the Torah is serious business, how much more so the words of Messiah? Kol v'homer. Same argument he's been using through the entire book. Not setting aside the Torah, but using the exalted place of Torah to make an argument for an even more exalted place of Messiah. Verse 30. We know him who said, "It is mine to avenge, I will repay." And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. So he's warning them with some very stiff words. And he's encouraging them. He is spurring them on to love and good deeds. Remember those early days? Verse 32, after you had received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest, in the face of suffering. He's referring here to the persecutions of the early days. We know those stories from the book of Acts. We know the story of Stephen. We know the story of the persecution that broke out after Stephen was stoned. We know the stories of like when the 12 were arrested and all 12 were flogged publicly. We know the story of how the believers were persecuted so intensely they were scattered from Jerusalem. So he's invoking this. He's saying, remember those days? Remember how you stood your ground? Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. So you need to persevere. So that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what He has promised. And this is why we keep on going. You might reach a point someday when you have no motivation to keep on going. You might reach a point someday when you feel like, you know what, as far as religion, I'm done. My motivation has evaporated. That's when you keep on going. Why? Because it is the will of God that we do so. We need to persevere and do the will of God over and above and beyond how we feel. You know, Shabbat is a wonderful thing in the home. Some of you have your family still with you. You can testify to this, that To have that one time, and for us in our house it doesn't work like this in the summer when Shabbat doesn't start till almost 10 p.m. But to have your family come together around the table Friday night and to know that this meal, I mean, you eat other meals, but this is one time. Don't leave the table yet. It's Shabbat, you know. You don't have to run off and do something. We're together. We're a family. We're just enjoying being a family here around the table at Shabbat. I'm the father. I want to see my children there. I want to see my family around the table. You know, maybe that's God's heart for His people. He said, you don't have any place to run off to. Don't give up the assembly. I want to see my people gathered together on the Shabbat. I want to see my assembly. I want to see my ecclesia. I want to see my church. So, we're gathered here. We're assembled here. Not just to sing songs or pray prayers, but to encourage one another. Verse 37 says, "For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come back and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith, and if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him." But we are not those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. As we assemble and commit to love and good deeds, the writer of the book of Hebrews tells us, we are drawing near to God. Our unredeemed minds don't think that way. We think that if we want to draw near to God, we should go up on a mountain or something and sit and meditate and or maybe we should sing worship songs till we get goosebumps or something. That's how we would think. That's how I would draw near to God. But feeling near and being near are not the same thing, are they? When we assemble together, spurring each other on to love and good deeds, we are drawing near to God. Which maybe could be understood in this respect, that the presence of God is not in a box. He's invested himself in human beings, in human hearts. And so when we assemble together, we are assembling with the presence of God invested into individuals, each other. When we love one another, overcoming the obstacles that it takes in order to love one another, and when we pursue the commands of God, fulfilling His will through faith, is what He says, then we're near to God. We are near to God. Not close to God, but in His presence. Not spatially close, like God is in the next room and I'm in this room, or God is up here and I'm out here, but in His very presence. We have drawn near into His presence. Aaron, if you could come up and close us out.